Earth at the very first possible opportunity that the physics of the Earth would permit it. I mean, at 3.83 billion years ago, we have the Earth in a molten state, and the moment that the Earth becomes cool enough where liquid water can arise and solid rocks, we have the origin of life. Well, a number of astronomers have said then that must mean that the origin of life is automatic everywhere in the universe. Since it happened immediately on the Earth, it must happen immediately anywhere else in the universe where you've got Earth-like conditions. Well, what these two astronomers point out is it ignores an important situation. Here on planet Earth, we not only have life, we've got human beings that can observe life and ponder about that life. And what they do in their research papers point out that it takes a minimum of 3.8 billion years to go from the first life to human beings by any model. You know, in fact, what you see in Psalm 104 in the Bible is how God aggressively creates life in the greatest possible abundance and diversity for as long as possible in order to enrich the crust of the earth with all the resources that human beings need to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization. And so what they point out in their paper is, given that the only way you can have human beings observing, or the equivalent of human beings observing the origin of life, is if only that life appeared immediately. Because if it doesn't appear immediately, you simply won't have the opportunity for humans to rise. Now there's two data points here. It takes 3.8 billion years for human beings to arrive here on the scene with the resources they need for technology after the first life appears, and you can't go any longer than 3.8 billion years. Because all stars get brighter and brighter as they get older and older once they initiate hydrogen burning in the furnace of their cores. And what that means is there will come a time when there will be so much luminosity being radiated from the sun that makes human life impossible. For all of your investment portfolios, I've got bad news for you. In less than 10 million years, the sun will be too bright to permit the existence of advanced life. All advanced life will disappear because the sun will now be too bright to sustain life. In fact, there will come a time shortly thereafter when all life on the planet will go extinct. And so we are at the end of the line, but we have to be at the end of the line. And so their conclusion is that when you use Bayesian statistical analysis, which means you take into account all these factors, the probability for life arising is not one, rather it's zero. From a naturalistic perspective, we would have a zero or indistinguishable from zero probability that life would arise. This is important because the astrobiology community has been using this assumption that because life arose immediately on the Earth, it must arise immediately anywhere Earth-like conditions arise. And they show, hey, given the context that human beings can only exist on a planet where life arises as soon as it's physically possible, doesn't mean that we have a high probability at all. In fact, it's much more likely that the probability is zero. So, and since I don't see anybody at the microphone, let me jump into another paper here. And this one, again, is not yet published, but it was announced at the American Astronomical Society meeting, the last meeting that they had. And it was a team of astronomers that were looking at the database of extrasolar planets. And that list now has beyond 560 planets discovered outside of our solar system where we got known characteristics for those planets. Actually, there's been about 2,000 discovered, but for about two-thirds of them, we haven't yet pinned down their orbital and physical characteristics. But there's over 560 where we've been able to do that. And what they're noticing is they did some mathematical models where if you have a gas giant, that's what a gas giant is, a planet like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. If you've got a planet like that, that's more distant from the star than Earth is from our star, the Sun, then the eccentricity of that planet will generate severe eccentricity oscillations in the Earth-like planet that could possibly exist in the same system. Eccentricity refers to the ellipticity of a planet's orbit. Every planet that goes around a star has an elliptical orbit, but when you look at our solar system, the orbits are only very slightly elliptical. And what these people, astronomers, are pointing out in their paper, if you've got a gas giant planet more distant than the Earth, then the ellipticity of that planet, unless it's extremely close to circular, will generate these catastrophic eccentricity variations. Bottom line of their paper is that will rule out the existence of advanced life, because advanced life requires stable circular orbits. What they're pointing out is this situation is going to give you conditions where you may get circular orbits, but it won't be stable. It'll be short-lived, and then you get these elliptical points. Now you say, well, maybe you could have life on a planet where you don't have any gas giant beyond the orbit of the Earth. But the truth is, it's vital for advanced life that you have gas giants beyond the orbit of the Earth. It's those gas giants that protect our planet Earth from taking too many hits from asteroids and comets. You know, I think we've all seen the hits that Jupiter's been taking over the past decade. Well, we can thank God that Jupiter is there, because if it wasn't, we'd be taking the hits instead of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And what's remarkable about our solar system is that the gas giants all have very circular orbits, and they're also just the right distances from one another that they don't set up mean motion resonances, which could also destabilize the orbit of a planet like Earth. So we have a highly protected orbit that has remained protected for 4.5 billion years, and what these gentlemen are pointing out is that's an extreme unlikelihood given their mathematical modeling. Hey, I see we got people at the microphone. I'm going to quit talking about new discoveries, but if that line ever gets short, I'm going to get into the rest of these discoveries. And hey, if you can't get enough of this, sign up for the podcast, sign up for today's New Reasons to Believe. We try to keep you up to date, at least on the more significant of these discoveries. But go ahead.
Shortly after I came to one of the classes, I saw a show on TV about Stephen Hawking. And basically the outcome of that show was that basically for the same reasons you say God exists, he said that God can't exist, using pretty much the same logic as far as my mind could understand it. And I was curious about that. Are you familiar with this claim that Stephen Hawking says there's no God?
Well, Stephen Hawking last September wrote a book along with a Caltech physicist titled The Grand Design. And you're right, he was appealing to the same evidence as I was appealing to, but drawing the opposite conclusion. And consequently, I've actually done quite a bit of public speaking on Hawking's book, The Grand Design. But what I think disturbed me the most about that book is about two-thirds of the way through, it makes a statement that we've discovered over 500 planets outside of our solar system. And all these planets that we've discovered prove that the characteristics of our solar system's planets are not at all extraordinary. They're very ordinary, completely expected, and therefore shows that we don't need a god to explain the special characteristics of the solar system that makes life possible here on the Earth. We're seeing it everywhere within our own galaxy. Now, he was counting on the fact that nobody would check up on it. The truth is, any layperson, you don't have to be an astronomer, can go to the internet and put in exoplanet encyclopedia into any search engine. That will come a site that's managed by the French astronomer Jean Schneider. And what he does is he has a table there where he lists all the physical and orbital characteristics of the planets that have been discovered outside of our solar system. And you can look at those listed characteristics and compare them with the characteristics of the planets in our solar system. And what you'll notice is that none of the 560 plus have characteristics that are anywhere near the characteristics of any of our solar system planets. And so it's the opposite of what Hawking claims. The discovery of these extrasolar planets is actually proving that the characteristics of our solar system planets are so exceptional that the only reasonable conclusion is that they've been supernaturally designed to have those characteristics. In fact, what the discovery of all these extrasolar planets has done in the past 15 years has shown that every planet in our solar system, with the exception of Pluto, but hey, Pluto's been demoted, so it doesn't count anymore, every solar system planet plays a critical role in making human life possible here on planet Earth. And as I've shared in the paradoxes class before, when Thanksgiving comes along, please put up a few words of thanks for the design of Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, because without that, you wouldn't be able to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. They all have special characteristics that make that possible. And yes, we found hundreds of gas giant planets, but none of them have the characteristics of Uranus, Neptune, Jupiter, and Saturn, characteristics that are critical for life. Now, to be fair to Stephen Hawking, he's not claiming there is no God. He is saying that if there is a God, God is not personal. And he argues that God is not personal because we don't see any evidence for any kind of exceptional characteristics or design in these planets. He also claims that biochemists have solved the origin of life problem, which is simply not true. In fact, it's the opposite. Every year of research that accumulates, the origin of life problem becomes more difficult for the naturalist to explain. And, Fuzz Ron and I have been attending Origin of Life conferences, and it's quite an experience to go to these conferences, because a typical research science conference is crackling with excitement about the new discoveries. When you go to an Origin of Life research conference, it's the opposite. There's this mood of despondency and despair over the fact that they're getting nowhere in trying to solve the problems. In fact, the problems are getting worse and worse with every meeting that comes by from a naturalistic perspective. But we have a book over there called Origins of Life, where we talk about our experiences at these conferences and also some of the private conversations we've been having with Origin of Life researchers, where they're frankly admitting that the naturalistic explanations are really producing no results. So, sorry for the long answer, but it's an important question that you raise, because a lot of people are appealing to Stephen Hawking as evidence that no personal God exists. But it's all based on faulty premises.
But nobody's challenging him officially?
Well, we're challenging him. So,
have you written him a letter?
No, I've not written him a letter, but you know what? Stephen is surrounded by believers. His research partner, Roger Penrose, though not a Christian, is a theist. And Stephen Hawking's had two wives who have both been evangelical Christians. Stephen had a friend of mine, Don Page, live in his home for 4 years. And Don and his first Stephen's first wife, Jane, would have daily prayer and Bible study with Stephen Hawking throughout that four-year period. So it's not that he hasn't been exposed to the gospel, but what both Don and Jane write is that with Stephen Hawking, you can get him to talk about God, but you can't get him to talk about a personal God. That's where the famous Hawking smirk comes up, which means end of conversation. You're next.
I've read that the Big Bang theory is kind of like a hand grenade that explodes outwards but starts to slow down. Can you kind of give me your thoughts on that?
That analogy has been used for the Big Bang. That's kind of like a grenade that you explode and then it gradually slows down with respect to time. The analogy is not tight in the sense that when a grenade explodes, the pieces of shrapnel move at different velocities. When the universe is created, all the bits and pieces of matter and energy move away from the point of creation at the same velocity. And so everything's on the surface of the universe. So it's not quite like a grenade where some of the pieces of shrapnel are moving more slowly than the others. Everything expands at the same rate in the universe. And it's also an extremely fine-tuned expansion. When you think about a grenade, it's chaotic. with the expansion of the universe, it actually ranks as the most fine-tuned or designed system that we can measure in all the sciences. That's where we actually get our most spectacular evidence for the supernatural design of the natural realm for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. So you need to think of it as a very carefully designed and controlled, quote, explosion. And so, in that sense, the grenade analogy fails.
So better language is you're saying it's a controlled explosion. So is there anything else that I could use in a physical conversation?
In our DVD Journey Toward Creation, we kind of talk a little bit about exactly what is this explosive expansion event. And, you know, we very carefully worded that, so you can just copy that verbatim. But the whole point is it's not a chaotic explosion. Rather, it's something that is more controlled than anything else we can measure in the natural realm. And we need to think of the universe as an analogy to planet Earth. Planet Earth has three physical dimensions, but we human beings live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. All the stars and galaxies, all the matter and energy, and even all the space-time dimensionality is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. And just one other aspect of the analogy. The grenade analogy was used before astronomers discovered dark energy. And the belief was that only gravity was influencing the expansion of the universe. And you all know how gravity operates. You've got two massive bodies, and the closer they are together, the more powerfully they attract. So Big Bang cosmology 30 years ago was the idea that when the universe is young, we got pieces of matter close enough together that it rather powerfully slows down the expansion of the universe. But the universe nevertheless continues to expand, which pushes the pieces of matter farther and farther apart. So as the universe gets older and older, gravity becomes less and less effective in slowing down the cosmic expansion. But today we realize that there's two factors governing the expansion of the universe. You've got gravity and dark energy. And dark energy is the energy embedded in the space surface of the universe that acts to accelerate the expansion of the universe. But the way dark energy operates is when the surface of the universe is small, it's rather feeble in its ability to accelerate the expansion of the universe. But as that surface gets bigger and bigger, it becomes progressively more and more powerful. And so there reaches a point where dark energy's effect is greater than that of gravity. Gravity's trying to slow it down, dark energy's trying to speed it up, but there's a point where the universe becomes big enough where dark energy supersedes the effect of gravity. And that's been the case for the last 7 billion years. So for the first 7 billion years, dark energy is too weak to do anything about the gravitational slowing down. But for the last 7 billion years, dark energy has been predominant. And this is something we can actually measure by looking at distant galaxies. We can see that the expansion rate indeed was slowing down for the first 7 billion years, but less and less so as you approach the end of that 7 billion years. And then for the past 7 billion years, it's been expanding at a progressively faster and faster rate, which means we can confidently conclude now that the universe can only have one beginning. Because of dark energy, there's no way the universe could ever collapse into a new stage of contraction followed by a restart of the expansion. Dark energy guarantees that it will continue to expand at a faster and faster rate. Okay, next question.
Yes, my question is also about the Big Bang and also how it relates to the cosmological argument. It's my understanding that before the Big Bang, there's no time, space, matter, or energy.
Right.
It has a beginning. But I was bringing something up to an atheist, and he said he cited the first law of thermodynamics, claiming, you know, since it says energy cannot be created or destroyed, he tried to use that as an argument that even though that matter didn't exist, he said energy still existed per the first law of thermodynamics. Would that only apply the physics of this known universe, or can he supersede that to a prior existence, say the multiverse or something else, or does it not apply?
Well, to restate the first law of thermodynamics, nothing can be created or destroyed once you get past the cosmic creation event. At the cosmic creation event, you get the beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. But that's a little simplistic. What you actually have at the very moment of creation is you have a universe with no matter, but you've got space curvature. And the space curvature is highly curved because the universe at that point has an infinitesimal volume. But it's a created dynamic, created with the dynamics of expansion. And so what happens after the very beginning of the universe is that space curvature becomes stretched, which means space curvature is released, and the release of that space curvature produces at about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the cosmic creation event, a flood of photons. So now you've got light in the universe. And when you get to about 10 to the minus 11 seconds, that heat or light energy in the universe produces the fundamental particles. And so by a trillionth of a second, you've got a universe of matter, energy, space, and time. But it starts off with just space and time. Then you get the heat energy, and that's followed by the matter. So, but hey, it's all done by 10 to the minus 11 seconds.
Okay, so obviously with the energy, he's not applying it correctly.
Well, it's kind of like Einstein's E equals mc squared. You can transform energy into matter and matter into energy. Well, it's also true you can transform space curvature into matter and energy. But there's a big difference. In Einstein's theory of special relativity, it's reversible. You can convert energy into matter or matter into energy. We've been able to do that routinely in scientific experiments. However, the conversion of space curvature into matter and energy is one way only. It's impossible to take the currently existing matter and energy and transform it back into space curvature. And so it's not a reversible process. And again, that's evidence that we're looking at a single cosmic beginning for the universe, where there must be a causal agent beyond space-time, matter, and energy that's responsible for bringing the universe into existence. The space-time theorists put it exactly that way. I mean, they don't say the God of the Bible, but they say a causal agent beyond space-time, matter, and energy. But as we pointed out at Reasons to Believe, what distinguishes the God of the Bible from the non-biblical religious faith is that in the Bible we have a God creating independent of space and time, whereas in the non-biblical faith, you've got God creating in space and time that eternally exists. And today we have the space-time theorems that eliminate the Eastern beliefs as being a credible explanation of the universe in which we live, and establish the Christian worldview doctrine.
Next. Cool. I have no problem with the Bible. I know what I believe, and definitely I can say I know God. Jeremiah 9:23-24. But I just have a curious question. You mentioned a few months ago that there's only maybe not too much gold in the world, and yet when you read the New Testament, they speak of gold here, shackles of gold here, pure gold. And so I just wonder, what happened to all that gold?
What happened to all that gold? Well, yeah, I wrote an article several months ago about the unusual abundance patterns of our planet Earth. How you can pick almost any element out of the periodic table, and the Earth appears to be extremely anomalous. Probably the most dramatic example, we have 23,000 times as much thorium as what you'd expect in any other Earth-like planet. We have 16,000 times as much uranium. And because we're so extremely enriched in uranium and thorium, we have the heat in the interior of the Earth that drives the plate tectonics, that makes the continents, and sets up a strong, stable magnetic field. And many astronomers believe that Earth stands alone in having those characteristics. But we're gold deficient. You would expect that we would have a little more gold than what we have. But the gold that we do have seems to come from extraterrestrial sources. I mean, most of you know that about 80% of the gold that exists on the planet has come from South Africa. Well, it's come from a crater site. And what they're now recognizing is there was an asteroid that hit that site, and it was a super gold-rich asteroid. And so, although the Earth itself didn't have a lot of gold, we picked up some gold thanks to this collider. So maybe we need to look elsewhere for collision sites and see if we can pick up some gold. But it's a good thing we don't have too much gold on the planet, because too much gold in the crust of the Earth would be a problem for advanced life. And this is something we notice in the various metals we see in the crust of the Earth, is that they all seem to be at the ideal levels for human beings. It's things that we call vital poisons, a group of metals where if you got too much in your diet, it will kill you. But if you don't have enough in your diet, it will also kill you. Or if it's in the wrong chemical form, it will kill you. And we notice here on planet Earth is all these vital metals are at the ideal chemical form, at the ideal abundance levels for human beings to thrive. And it's one of the explanations. I told you earlier it takes 3.8 billion years minimum to bring human beings upon the scene after you got life. Well, it's because that early life works to transform those metals. That's one of the reasons why you have to wait those 3.8 billion years, because the primordial Earth has the metals in the wrong chemical forms, and it's bacteria that transform those metals. But I think you can see the hand of the Creator here. You don't want that bacterial activity to be too aggressive, because if it's too aggressive, you won't have sufficient amount of those metals in your diet. But if it's not aggressive enough, you'll have too much. Either way, you get killed. So a word of warning, when you go to the health food store, don't overload too much on zinc or chromium or selenium or copper. All those things are good to have in your diet, but too much is deadly. Not enough is deadly. And so make sure you're taking just the right amount of supplements, or maybe just eat the right kinds of foods where you don't have to spend all those that exorbitant sums of money to buy those supplements at the health food store. So, next question.
Yeah, do you have the highest IQ in the universe?
Well, that's an interesting story, because I don't know what my IQ is, but I did have one of these Cadillac-type IQ tests done on me when I was 15 or 16, and that was before they knew what autism and Asperger's syndrome was all about. In fact, I didn't discover I had that till just a few years ago. But I remember the psychologist who was testing me. She was testing the 25 top science students in the Vancouver area, and I was one of those 25 students, and she says, "You're really a mystery." Says, "You're the only student I've tested that's gotten 100% on these parts of the IQ test. So I've never seen that before. But you're also the only student that I've ever tested that's gotten a zero in all these other parts of the test." So, says, "You know, I've interviewed people who've been severely retarded and they did way better than you on these parts of the test." I tell you all that because, you know, if you know your IQ score, take it with a grain of salt. Because IQ tests are typically testing different components of intellectual performance, and I would bet that every one of you is exceptional in one area and pretty crummy in some other areas. But, you know, people who, like me, have Asperger's syndrome or autism, we tend to show that more extremely than the rest of the population. But what it has taught me is there's certain things I can do a lot better than the rest of the population, but there's other things I just can't do at all. In fact, if you're curious, where I got the zero is they gave me all these little cartoon things, one clip at a time, and I was supposed to put them in the correct chronological order, and she said I was the only one that put it in exactly the opposite order every time. But they were little cartoon stories of romances, and so couldn't do that. Probably explains why I didn't get married till I was 32. So,
I hope you're not going to include that as my question. I was just.
Oh, sorry.
But I must say that when I listen to you, my brain starts to hurt a little. It's just, it's a compliment. I'm just saying that you're. Anyways, I wanted to ask you with the God. I mean, I'm still kind of agnostic, but I still can't wrap myself around. Well, let me just explain it this way. When Jesus was on the cross and he was dying, before he died, I mean, did he say, well, wait, I got to take on all of mankind's sins, past, present, and future? So I don't know how he does it, but he takes on all the sins. Did God sort of say, there you go, or did he just... But then he says to his to God, why have you forsaken me? And then does God say, well, you're so, sort of like the story, the picture of Dorian Gray, you know, where he does all these, the picture becomes ugly. So I don't know if that's what happened to Jesus, that he became so putrid in all these sins that he couldn't look at them. And then maybe God just said, well, enough's enough, you're going to die, that's it. And then he says, it's accomplished. But then does God say, well, you did pretty good, but I want you to go to hell or Toledo, whatever you prefer. But, I want you to go to hell and pick up some people. Be it like a warden or a prison warden. Give them a reprieve. But before you do that, I want you to spend time with your followers. Let them know that you're doing well. 40 days. He has a thing with 40. 40 days in the desert, 40 days in the... Moses was 40 years in the desert, and they named a plant after them, the wandering Jew plant. So he was with his followers, and he stays there. And then he says, "Okay, I gotta go. I'll send you a postcard, or better still, I'll send you the Holy Spirit." The Holy Spirit stays and is within them. I still don't get. I can't get how these sins come into him, and everybody is absolved. They all live free. I don't get it. If you can explain that to me.
First of all, I've been to Toledo. I don't think it's quite that bad. Oh. So. Now, you've raised some very good questions there. There's several questions. I'll try to pick them up one at a time. You're right that when Jesus was dying on the cross, he began to speak. And it's remarkable that in the physical condition he was actually able to speak. And the first words we see recorded in the Bible as he was dying on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the last words he speaks are, it is finished. Now, we're not told what he said in between. What we are told is that there was an unbelieving Roman centurion that was supervising the crucifixion, listening to the words of Jesus. And when Jesus died on the cross, he said, surely this is the Son of God. Something happened as he was listening to those words that persuaded this unbelieving Roman centurion that this indeed was the creator of the universe, the Son of God himself. Well, it does tell us in the text that he was respectful of the Jewish faith. And therefore, it's quite likely that he was well-versed in the Jewish scriptures. And if you were to open your Bible to Psalm 22, it begins with, my God, why have you forsaken me?
And that's from King David? Is that from King David?
That's King David. King David wrote Psalm 22 1,000 years before Jesus died on the cross. But the opening verse is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And if you read it in the original Hebrew, the last sentence is, it is finished. And so what you see recorded in the gospel text is Jesus quoting the first verse of Psalm 22 and then the last verse, but evidently the centurion was listening to all the words Jesus was speaking. Well, again, if you look at Psalm 22, it's a detailed prophecy of exactly how the Messiah would finish his life and dying for the sins of the whole world. And if you look carefully at Psalm 22, it talks about how there would be a band of Gentiles surrounding him who would gamble to see who would get his clothes. Well, you can imagine the centurion watching his soldiers doing that very thing. Psalm 22 actually prophesies the very words that the Jewish leaders would speak in mocking him while he was dying on the cross. And so you can imagine again the centurion listening to Jesus quoting Psalm 22 and seeing all the events being fulfilled right in front of his eyes, including the fact that his side would be pierced and that he would die a death by crucifixion. All that's detailed in Psalm 22. And so, you know, I've often looked at Psalm 22 as one of the most remarkable prophecies in the Old Testament, written 1,000 years before the crucifixion of Jesus, but detailing everything that would happen as he was dying on the cross. And so here's a Roman centurion listening to Jesus quote Psalm 22, realizing all this is being fulfilled right before his eyes. We can understand why this would have such a dramatic conversion experience for that Roman centurion. But then you ask another question. He was on the cross, and if you look at the gospel accounts, that period from the time he was put up on the cross until he actually died is only 9 hours. And yet we're told in the New Testament epistles that during those 9 hours, Jesus atoned or paid for the offenses of every human being who has ever lived. Now that's a fairly big offense that he's got to take care of in just 9 hours. And we can appreciate that death by crucifixion is the most excruciatingly painful way for anyone to die, but other people went through that. And, you know, skeptics have pointed out it's only 9 hours. But notice that the text makes quite clear this wasn't just a human being dying on the cross, it was the creator of the universe himself. He was both human and divine. And because he had divine characteristics, he had the capacity to suffer in a way that a human being could not suffer. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly how he appropriates those divine characteristics to take care of the atonement price for all the offenses of the human race, past, present, and future. However, in a book over there called Beyond the Cosmos, we give you some suggestions of how God could do it, given what physics tells us must be the minimum power that the creator of the universe possesses. So, for example, we speculate that if Jesus were to suffer in 3 independent dimensions of time or their equivalent, what would be 9 hours for us could be the equivalent of an infinite number of years. And so in 9 hours of time, Jesus, as the creator of the universe, could literally compress that much time of suffering into that brief window of time in our temporal context. I'm not saying that's the way he did it. I'm just saying we have the knowledge in physics today that God could do it given his minimal attributes. And therefore, we need to appreciate the depth of what he went through when he was on the cross. It explains why he went to the cross with the trepidation that he had, because he knew exactly what he was going to experience when he was on the cross. He was literally going to pay the atonement price for every human being who has ever lived, all of our offenses against God and against one another, past, present, and future. As it tells us in Hebrews 2:3, who can ignore such a great salvation offer? If he has done that for each one of us, who in their rational and right mind can possibly turn down such a magnificent offer? And that's what Jesus did on the cross. He offered to every human being to trade his moral perfection for our moral imperfection. And so we appreciate what he actually paid for us on the cross. It's like, you know, this seems like a no-brainer. I'm going to transfer my moral imperfection for his moral perfection. I'm not sure I covered all of your questions. If you want to come back to the microphone, I'll pick up whatever else you want to ask. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Russ. Yeah, since we're bad-mouthing Stephen Hawking, I have a short quotation from him I just read a couple of days ago. He says, I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken-down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark.
Well, it's an interesting statement from Stephen Hawking, and I would recommend that you read a couple of books from his co-author, Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose deserves equal fame with Stephen Hawking for developing the first of the space-time theorems. But it was Roger Penrose, and by the way, Roger's a little bit different than Stephen. Stephen says there's a God, but it's not a personal God. Roger Penrose is not a Christian, but he says there's got to be a being out there that has purpose for the universe and purpose for the human species. He said that a couple of times on the British Broadcasting Network. But in two books he wrote on the human brain, he said what we see in the brain are three attributes. We see the attributes of the hardware of a computer. I mean, it's filled with memory elements, and it's filled with the ability to do complex calculations. And so it emulates the hardware of a computer. But he says, in addition to that, we see software there, and more than that, we see that there's a programmer. Now, what he was commenting on is how the physical universe might be able to explain the hardware features of the human brain, but it can't explain the software, and there's no answer for the programmer. The fact that there's actually someone there that's interfacing with the brain to make it do the things that it does. And that's kind of what the Christian faith is all about, is that God has given us this human body, and we have this brain, and it's an interface for our spirit. Our spirit is able to communicate and do the things that it does because it has this piece of hardware interface. And when the hardware interface fails, when you've got brain injuries or as you get older and you get dementia or whatever, the spirit is still there. The spirit is still vital, but because the interface is crippled, it doesn't have the capacity any longer to communicate with people in the outside realm, or at least not to the same degree. But death for the human being, according to the Bible, is where you abandon the crippled interface and God gives you a new interface. So the spirit remains intact. And it's the spirit that takes the role of the programmer and controls the software components in the brain and the hardware.
I think if I had your IQ, I'd be with Stephen Hawking and Penrose. But anyhow, I have a small...
Well, you might want to read a debate between Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking. It's a book-length debate that's been published where you've got Stephen the deist debating with Penrose the theist about the physics of space, time, and God. It might be quite entertaining for you. I've got the book if you want to take a look at it.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment on Alan's question. God, when he died on the cross, essentially for our sins, or so they say, didn't die. He never died. He died for 3 days, and then he went up to heaven. He didn't die for our sins. I could have done that. I mean, if my father told me, you're going to undergo this excruciating torture and pain, but don't worry about it, because in 3 days, you're going to come up and you're going to be with me in heaven. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, it does. But keep in mind that the Bible talks about a triune God.
Well, there we go.
Where you got, you know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
He didn't die, is what I'm saying.
Well, now what you're bringing up there is a very important point, Al, is that because of the triune nature of the Creator, he could be simultaneously dead and alive. And so the Holy Spirit was there, the Father was there. And if you actually read through the New Testament accounts of this, it will say that the Holy Spirit raised Jesus from the dead. Another passage you'll find where it says the Father raises Jesus from the dead. Another passage will say that Jesus rose himself bodily from the dead. And yet the text says there's only one resurrector. Only one resurrects Jesus from the dead. But all three take credit for raising Jesus from the dead. Just like all three take credit for the creation of the universe, and yet there's only one creator. This is the doctrine that God is one essence and three persons. Now, from our human perspective, that sounds like a mathematical contradiction. In fact, that's the struggle I had with my own mother for many years after I became a Christian. She kept saying, Christianity is impossible because it presents us with a mathematical absurdity. How can three and one be the same at the, you know, same at the same time? Well, it's not that they're three and one in all contexts at the same time. In one context is three, in another context it's one.
In religion, there is no everything is possible. Well, in religion, everything is possible.
Yeah, but you know what impressed me as a young man going through the holy books of religions of the world? you only find the doctrine of the triunity of God in the Bible. It's in no other holy text. And it's something that no human being would ever conceive of from our limited human perspective. And so what I saw in these other holy books are descriptions of God that we human beings could fully comprehend and understand. What we see in the Bible is something that transcends our human understanding, which means that here alone we have the possibility of a message that comes from someone who has experiences beyond length, width, height, and time. You know, we would expect that there would be mysteries we couldn't fully comprehend if indeed the message is coming from a transcendent source. Next question.
My name is Gloria, and I have one comment and two questions. Speaking of Stephen Hawking, I think that Einstein said that the reason for time is so that everything doesn't happen at one time. And when I read that, I thought that was just beautiful. It's just so practical. One of my questions is, in the Old Testament, whenever God's name is written out, it's written out Jehovah, and but it's pronounced Adonai, even though that's not what it says in Hebrew. Do you know why?
Well, there's many different Hebrew names for God in the Old Testament. One is Yahweh, one is Adonai, the other one is Elohim. There are many others. In fact, if you go through the entire Old Testament, you'll find 88 different names for the Son of God. And each of those names is describing a certain attribute of God.
But I'm talking about God, not the Son of God.
Well, okay. I mean, keep in mind the Son of God also takes the title Yahweh and Adonai. They actually, you know, all members take the same names. Well, again, it's part of the doctrine of the Trinity.
What does Adonai mean? Doesn't that mean God?
It means God. Yeah, it's one of the names for God.
It is a name?
Yahweh, for example, communicates the authority of God over all reality. Elohim means the uniplural one. So that's the very first word you see for God in Genesis chapter 1. It uses the word Elohim. In Genesis chapter 1, you get the first introduction of the doctrine of the triune nature, the Godhead, and it purposely uses this word for God that means the one who is simultaneously singular and plural. And you see that kind of brought out towards the end of Genesis 1, where God says, "Let us create man." And so God created man. So he created man. Notice it's flipping the singular and the plural pronouns. Say, why is the text using that name? You know, the all-compassionate one, or the all-wise one. I mean, so that's why you see all these different names being used. And what's also interesting is that the different members of the Godhead actually take the same names. So in Jeremiah, the Son of God is called Yahweh. And yet, you know, Jews believe that there's only one Yahweh. But in the Old Testament itself, God the Father takes the title Yahweh, so does the Son of God take the title Yahweh. Yet there's only one God. Again, the doctrine of the Trinity.
Because I had a Jehovah's Witness explain to me that the reason she converted to be Jehovah's Witness was because Jehovah is God's name. And then she just said that what that means is, like, my husband's name was David. And so God's name was Jehovah. Just that's the way she explained it to me, was that was
right.
Just his name.
Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses deny the doctrine of the Trinity, and they believe there's only one God, it's God the Father, that Jesus is not God. However, when it came to Jeremiah 23, that's the statement that says the name by which he will be called is Yahweh, referring to the Messiah, God's Son. Well, if you look in the Jehovah's Witness Bible, they changed the sentence. They took the verb out. But, you know, none of the manuscripts support the translation of the New World Translation of Jehovah's Witnesses. And, you know, when I've talked to Jehovah's Witnesses, that's kind of what I do. I point out all the places that their translation altered the text. And, you know, why are they altering the text? Well, each place they alter the text, it's in order to remove from the Bible the doctrine of the triunity of God. But the triunity of God may be really what God is all about. Let God be God and every man a liar. And as I said before, what attracted me about the doctrine of the triunity of God is it transcends the limits of human visualization, which means that this book indeed may come from a non-human source. That's one thing that caused me to be skeptical about Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, is that they all describe God in the way that we human beings can completely understand and visualize.
And my final question is there a conflict between dinosaurs on Earth and the creation theory and Adam and Eve? Do those all fit in together if you take the Bible literally?
Not at all, unless you visit the Creation Museum in Kentucky. Okay. I would place dinosaurs on Creation Day 5. I would also point out that the Bible is silent on dinosaurs, and for good reason. This book was written to communicate to people living over a span of 3,500 years, and it's only been in the last 200 years when human beings became cognizant of the past existence of dinosaurs. So just like this book is silent on neutrinos, likewise it's silent on Neanderthals and on dinosaurs, because this is material that would have only been knowledgeable to people living in the last couple of hundred years. But as to where they would fall, Creation Day 5. Creation Day 5, in my opinion, begins with the Cambrian and Avalon explosions that took place 540 and 575 million years ago, and then moves into the dinosaur eras, which transcend from 250 million years ago to 65 million years ago, and then the fifth creation day closes out with God creating birds and sea mammals, which would be kind of like 150 million years ago up until a few tens of thousands of years ago. So that's where the dinosaurs would fit, and the people at the Creation Museum in Kentucky, in my opinion, are wrong when they say that dinosaurs cohabited with human beings. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. Human beings were driven to extinction by several extraterrestrial collision events. Each of the generations of dinosaurs, the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous, were driven to extinction by extraterrestrial collision events, the last of which took place 65 million years ago. But thanks in part to dinosaurs, we've got the biodeposits we need to launch and sustain civilization. So again, when you have Thanksgiving dinner, you might want to thank God for God creating all those dinosaurs hundreds of millions of years ago. Thanks.
So in the lectures I've attended and by just plain vanilla scientists and reading, it appears to me that scientific orthodoxy is moving towards the theory of the multiverse as an explanation for everything that we see, how life, well, not just how life began, but how our universe began with the anthropic principle, everything being just perfect for life. In other words, there are infinite number of universes, and we just happen to be in the one that is well suited for life as we know it. And it seems that the theory that's invoked to enable that theory is quantum mechanics. Now, given those two theories, it seems that just about anything is possible, and we don't need to explain anything with God. So, two questions. Number one, would you agree with that? That between quantum mechanics and the multiverse, it does explain, that provides a natural explanation for everything. And second, is there a way to falsify that approach to believing in the multiverse?
Okay. We have quite a bit of material in the multiverse. My colleague Jeff Zwierink, another astronomer on our staff, has written a booklet on the multiverse. Chances are we got it right over there. You'll also find about 7 pages on the multiverse in my book, More Than a Theory. So that's the short version. You can get the longer version in Jeff's booklet. And we point out that it's not a coincidence that the multiverse has come about only in the last few years. What drove the proposal of the multiverse is the recognition by physicists and astronomers that there's overwhelming evidence for design in the universe for the benefit of human beings. That's almost a verbatim quote from Paul Davies in his book, The Cosmic Blueprint. The second to last sentence was, when we look at the universe, we see overwhelming evidence for design. Or to quote another physicist, Freeman Dyson, he said, when you examine the universe, you cannot avoid the conclusion that somehow the universe knew we were coming. It was designed in advance for the appearance of life in human beings in particular. Well, what's an unbeliever going to do with that kind of overwhelming evidence? They have to come up with something. And whenever you lack a naturalistic explanation beyond all reasonable doubt, you always appeal to the infinity. This is not the first time people have appealed to the infinity to try to get rid of evidence for supernatural design. And so I think the timing needs to be pointed out. No one ever proposed it until they were kind of boxed into a corner where they had nowhere else to go. And just to kind of phrase the argument is, yes, we see all this evidence for exquisite fine-tuning everywhere in the universe for the benefit of life and human beings in particular, but what if there's an infinite number of universes, where in that infinite number of universes, every conceivable set of properties of universes would exist in that infinite sample? Then you could argue that we, by chance, live in the lucky universe where everything is just right. But to be honest, you need more than an infinite number of universes. You need an infinite number of an infinite number of universes. And I think one of the better critiques of the multiverse is that it explains way too much. If you really believe that, then what you're looking at would be an infinite number of planets exactly like planet Earth. And on those infinite number of planet Earths, you would have an infinite number of beaches with random markings in the sand. And an infinite number of random markings in the sand that would be identical to all the words you see in Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design, which means that Stephen Hawking's book was not written by an intelligent being, rather it's a product of pure chance of the multiverse. Bottom line is, no scientist thinks that way, no human being thinks that way, and so what you're doing is pointing out the philosophical inconsistency of appealing to the universe to get rid of God, but using a completely different paradigm to explain why you chose a particular woman to marry, or a particular career to pursue, or a particular book to write. So there's a philosophical inconsistency in there. We also point out it's a form of the gambler's fallacy. One is an illustration I use in More Than a Theory, is someone flipping a coin a million consecutive times where it comes up heads every single time and concluding that it's simply a product of chance. Well, I can tell you this, if you see a coin coming up 10 times in a row, it's not the product of chance. That coin has been fixed. That's not going to happen with a normal coin, especially not a million times. But one appealing to the multiverse would say, what if there's an infinite number of coins being flipped by an infinite number of people? The laws of probability tell us one of those will have a million consecutive heads by pure chance. Well, we have no evidence for the infinite number of coins. We have no evidence for an infinite number of people flipping them. And we have no evidence that the others are all producing different results. What if they're all coming up with a million consecutive heads? Moreover, you can go to that person who's saying, I'm going to bet heads or tails on the next flip regardless because I think this is pure chance. Well, I would advise that person, before you bet tails after seeing a million consecutive heads, look carefully at the coin. You know, make sure it doesn't have heads on both sides. Make sure it hasn't been weighted in such a way as to always produce heads. We can do that with the universe. We can choose to measure the universe in more detail and with greater precision than we have since the beginning of human time. And of making those measurements, we discover that the evidence for fine-tuning design gets greater rather than smaller. That's a test that strikes out the multiverse. From a multiverse perspective, you would anticipate that the evidence for design would get less and less as you make more and more measurements. If God's behind it, you expect the evidence to become more convincing or persuasive that there is fine-tuning design there. And if you look at our books, we document that in terms of the characteristics of fine-tuning design of our galaxy and our solar system to make advanced life possible, that evidence gets approximately a factor of a million times stronger every month. So on that basis, I don't think the multiverse from an atheistic perspective is on very good grounds. You asked a good question, though. Could it be falsified? Now, what scientists do agree on is there's no way to prove the multiverse by measurements, but there is a way to disprove it. All atheistic multiverse models require an open geometry for the universe. And right now there's a satellite orbiting the Earth that's very carefully measuring that geometry. It has the possibility, not the probability, of being able to make a measurement of the cosmic geometry that would rule out the atheistic multiverse models. But to be honest, I'm expecting it's going to give us an increasing confidence that it has a perfectly flat geometry. A perfectly flat geometry will not eliminate the multiverse speculations.
Which satellite is that?
That's the Planck satellite. The WMAP satellite already produced a result that showed that the universe was either perfectly flat or very slightly closed. But it left enough of an error bar to leave open the possibility that it might be open. And so it's one of the motivations for the Planck satellite is to measure that geometry with about a factor of 10 times greater precision. I expect the result will be published in about 6 to 12 months, so I might be able to give you a better answer. And yeah, there may even be a possibility that we'll be able to rule out those speculations, but there is no way to ever prove it. You know, if God made 10,000, we'll never know.
The statement in the Bible that God so loved the world, he gave his one and only Son, that whoever should believe in him should have eternal life, is used by a lot of Christians and particularly pastors and people in sermons as a rationale for statement that this was a huge, huge sacrifice on God's part and could not in any way be compared with us losing a loved one or a relative through death, that this was far more traumatic to God than anything we could possibly lose.
Right.
I can't understand that at all, because God knew Jesus was simply going to another phase of what his plan was, and he would be back as part of the Trinity very shortly again. I'm not sure why this is used as such an argument as a huge sacrifice on God's part.
Well, there's something in Matthew 7 where it says, if you will not forgive others the offenses they've committed against you, my Father will not forgive you. And it's based on the premise that what Jesus suffered on our account is so great that none of us has the excuse of saying, I suffered more than God did. And therefore, for us to refuse to forgive when he has forgiven us of something of far greater magnitude is simply irrational. And I think that's the basis of these preachers putting into their sermons explanations of the magnitude of what Christ suffered on the cross. And it's a theme you see in the book of Hebrews repeatedly. I've already mentioned Hebrews chapter 2, that if we actually measure what he did for us. And I think one of the ways of measuring it is that the penalty for the offense of human beings against what they did to God and their rebellion against God's authority and one that created us and has authority over us is eternal torment in the lake of fire. And so what Christ suffered on the cross was the equivalent of eternal torment multiplied by every human being who ever lived. And before I gave my life to Christ, I actually went through the calculation, well, what does that add up to? And I figured, well, minimum 40 to 50 billion people have lived since God created Adam and Eve. And so what Christ suffered on the cross was torment that's greater than what any of us can think or imagine for all of eternity, infinite time, multiplied by 50 billion. That's a pretty big sacrifice.
Okay. So we should really, in thinking about that, be focusing on the sacrifice and the suffering rather than the concept of loss, which in an earthly sense, we lose a relative, it's a loss to us in our earthly realm. but to God that wasn't really a loss of his son. It was that his that Jesus
well, there was a loss in the sense that the text tells us that when Jesus was suffering the penalty for all the offenses of human beings, God the Father turned his back and separated himself from his son. And that was an extremely painful experience for Jesus of Nazareth, because, you know, for all of eternity he had this wonderful relationship with God the Father and God the Holy Spirit, and for a period of time that was broken. Now, it was broken for 9 hours in our time context, but this was God dying on the cross. And therefore, we need to think of it as something far greater than just a mere passage of 9 hours of time. God was literally suffering and being separated from God the Father for the equivalent of all the offenses of human beings. So, in that sense, there was a tremendous loss and brokenness of relationship between God the Father and God the Holy Spirit and God the Son. But yeah, it was restored once the atonement penalty had been paid.
So Jesus atoned for about 40 billion people's sins, and it wasn't just probably one sin per person, there were probably more. So, but that doesn't mean that all those 40 or 50 billion are going to be saved. Those people would then have to say, he died for my sins, I'm going to try and follow in his way. So it's not just, say, believing he did it, but you have to follow a certain lifestyle that Jesus would approve of, right? I guess, is that it?
Well, I think a better way is to say that the Son of God offers a sacrifice as a gentleman. He doesn't force the gift upon you, he offers it. But he waits for you to receive it. It's made available to everyone, but he doesn't push it on you or force it on you. So if you want the gift, you can have it. But you don't have to take it if you don't want it.
Right.
It's kind of like a father making a gift to his son at Christmas time. You know, the son has the right to say, I don't want that, and walk away from it. Well, God the Father treats the human species the same way. We are free-willed beings, so he treats us as free-willed beings. He gives us the gift and say, it's yours if you want it.
Now, God, you have free will, but on the other hand, in other words, if I was to walk over there and make a right instead of a left, that's my free choice.
Right.
But God knows in advance I'm going to make that right because it's my free choice. Does that make sense? Or if I was going to make a left?
You need to go over there and get the book Beyond the Cosmos, where we talk about the paradox of predestination and free will. I mean, you're raising a very interesting point. By the way, that was another thing that attracted me about the Bible as I was comparing the different holy books as a young man, is the Bible stood alone in saying it's free will and predestination. When I picked up the Quran, it was only predestination. There was no free will.
Right.
When I looked at Hinduism and Buddhism, it was all free will. There is no predestination. In the Bible, it taught both. In fact, I found 9 verses in the Bible where it taught both doctrines in the same verse. And if you're not familiar with this, the doctrine of predestination is the teaching that God, from before he created the universe, predetermined every thought I would think, every word I would speak, every action I would perform throughout my entire life. It was all preordained before he created the universe. But the doctrine of free will says that God is holding me responsible for all the thoughts I think, all the words I speak, and all the actions I perform. And from a human perspective, the doctrine of free will is like God's not involved at all. The doctrine of predestination, from a human perspective, is if we human beings have no role at all. And from a human perspective, that explains the teachings you see in the Hindu Vedas and the Quran, for example. But God is transcendent of space and time. And a being that's transcendent to space and time would have the power to operate in such a way where he would control everything and in no way interfere with our free will decisions. Now, if you're interested in the book Beyond the Cosmos, I show you 3 different ways God can do that in the context of his operations in the equivalent of 3 dimensions of time or more. Good chance I'm wrong in all 3. But what I did in that book is show that if we allow God to be as powerful as what our physics tells us he must be, he certainly has options where it can be both. You don't have to choose one and reject the other.
Just real quickly, though, if all those 40 billion people were, let's just hypothetically say 1 billion out of the 40 are going to be saved and follow Jesus and the other 30 are not, couldn't Jesus have just taken on the 1 billion sins, saved us time and trouble for the other 30 billion if they weren't going to follow him anyways?
Well, Alan, that's actually a debate that's been raging within the Christian community for the last 1,000 years. Does Jesus on the cross simply die for those who are going to receive the gift, or does he die for everybody? I mean, if you look in the history of Calvinistic doctrines, you've got what's called four-pedal Calvinism and five-pedal Calvinism. The four-pedal people believe that Jesus died for everybody, including those who reject the gift. The five-pedal people say, based on the doctrine of predestination, he only dies for the elect, because he knew ahead of time who had received the gift, so there was no need for him to pay the penalty for all those who reject the gift. Now, if you want to know where I stand personally, I believe he died for everybody. Because as I look at the New Testament, it's like those who reject the gift of God are told that they have no excuse. Their Savior died for them, paid their penalty, and they rejected a gift that God made available to them personally. So on that basis, I'm four-pedal, I'm not five-pedal. But this is a current debate that is, to this day, taking place within the Christian community.
I think you're beginning to scare the hell out of me.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
In the short-term creationists museum, do they show the Flintstones as a docudrama?
Well, that's been a common response from skeptics of the Creation Museum in Kentucky, is that whoever designed it somehow believes that the Flintstones is a documentary.
Yeah.
So, but we have a photograph at our office which shows one of our staff members on a saddle on a dinosaur at the Creation Museum.
Well, I think so, one of them has Jesus on the saddle, the back of a...
Well, that could be.
Of a dinosaur. Yeah.
The whole point is you've got to put it to the test. Right. Just because a Christian is saying that it's so doesn't mean that it's so.
Right.
You have to testify the Word of God. You've got to testify the book of nature that God gave us. And
yes,
it kind of grieves me that so many people ridicule the Christian faith as a result of the visit to that Creation Museum. Are we going to make a museum? No. We think we got better uses for the resources God has given us. We're not going to build a museum.
I want to make one comment in regard to what was brought up about the Jehovah's Witnesses, that their New World Translation, we know 5 of the 7 translators, and none of them knew Greek or Hebrew. So
yeah,
they could not have translated the text from Greek and Hebrew. Franz and Knorr, president and vice president, both were presidents at one time, in 1954 in Scotland, Franz, I believe it was Franz and not Knorr, stated that he knew Greek, Hebrew, French, German, etc. for his Bible studies. And so he stated, you know, he knew how to translate from Hebrew and the Greek. However, next day, under cross-examination, they put up a verse in Genesis, the examiners, and they said, read that, and he couldn't. And he admitted he did not know Hebrew. So he perjured himself, lied in court, and that's all in the court transcripts from that those proceedings. And he did not know Greek or Hebrew, and yet he gave the final translation from the Greek and Hebrew. So a little interesting tidbit.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, I have a comment and a question. My comment is I'm making the transition from being a young earth creationist to, I guess, a progressive creationist is kind of what you guys believe in some of that.
Yeah, we take what's called the day-age view.
Or day-age view.
Right.
So I'm still learning some of that. But I guess the biggest thing for me, or one of the biggest things that kind of made me think about a literal 24-hour day in Genesis is if when you look in day 6 where Adam names all the animals, and of course some of these names have predatory names, and it takes time to map out behavioral patterns to see how animals hunt and different things. And it seems pretty incoherent to
have him name all the animals according to their behaviors and get lonely all before the 25th day, making it be or 25th hour, making it being the seventh day. So that to me doesn't seem to jive with a literal 24-hour period. But my question is, now correct me if I'm wrong, but seems like I heard you say on one of your podcasts that the flood of Genesis happened 30,000 years ago. Is that correct?
Well, I would say 40 plus or minus 20,000.
Okay.
I mean, it's hard to pin down the dates with any great precision. But what we do know is that we have the Garden of Eden in a place where these four rivers come together, the Gihon, the Pishon, the Tigris, and the Euphrates. And they don't come together anywhere on the planet today, but they did at the close of the last ice age in what's called the Gulf Oases. Most of the Persian Gulf was dry land at the close of the last ice age. And so we believe the flood took place at a time when the Persian Gulf was inundated, as well as Mesopotamia and large chunks of what is now southern Arabia, which would mean you would need a date a lot earlier than the traditional date of, say, 5,500 years ago. And it's also based on our calibration of the Genesis 11 genealogy, where you go from Noah down to Abraham. And for Abraham, we've got good dates both in the Bible and outside the Bible that puts them at about 4,000 years ago. And then the fifth name mentioned in the genealogy is Peleg. And Genesis 10:25 tells us in the days of Peleg, the world was divided. And I believe that's a reference to the rising of the sea levels that opened up or closed off the land bridges that were joining Siberia to Alaska, France to England, Korea to Japan, and elsewhere in the world, which would have prevented the peoples that got it scattered over the face of the earth from coming back and repeating the errors of the people that were arriving just after the flood. And if Peleg lived at the time of the breaking of the great land bridges, that would be about 11 to 14,000 years ago, and Abraham 4,000 years ago, and the lifespans recorded in Genesis 11 are proportional to the passage of time. That puts Noah somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 years ago.
Okay, a question with that is, I know the young earth creationists use, you know, the genealogies and to say that, you know, the world was created, you know, 6,000 years ago. Because, you know, what Adam lived, what, 930 years, was it?
Yes.
Somewhere around there. And so through the genealogies, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around how they use the genealogies to say the earth was a literal 6,000, and then you say it was about...
Well, some young earth creationists will say there are no gaps in the genealogies at
all.
But
there are, probably, right?
That would be like Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis. Henry Morris, however, felt that there were a few gaps in the genealogies, so he was willing to go back 10,000 years.
So that expands the time with the gap.
Yeah, okay. And then I've met other young earth creationists who said we're willing to go back 50,000 years. So not all young earth creationists will argue that there are no gaps in the genealogies. And there's good evidence biblically that there must be gaps. So, for example, you've got in the book of Luke a genealogy that takes you from Adam down to Noah, and it has a name that's not present in the Genesis 5 genealogy. So it establishes that at least one name was dropped out of the Genesis 5 genealogy. And if you actually do a study of the genealogies in the Bible, you'll see that they all leave out names. That's a question of how many names are left out, and theologically, why are certain names being dropped? You also notice in the Old Testament, it loves to use number patterns. So, for example, in Matthew, you've got three sets of 14 names running from Adam down to Jesus. But if you compare it with the genealogies and Chronicles, you'll notice a whole lot of names got dropped out in order to have the pattern of 14, 14, and 14. What you see in Genesis 5 and 11 is the pattern of 10 and 10. The Genesis 5 genealogy, only 10 names. The Genesis 11 genealogy, only 10 names. And therefore, certain names got dropped out. Probably the scholar has done the most extensive work on just how complete these genealogies are would be, I'm trying to think of his name, Walt Kaiser. Walt Kaiser has done probably the greatest amount of research of any man alive today on that subject. And I'm not sure if we have it on the table here, but we actually feature a debate with Walt and me versus Ken Ham and Jason Lyle. And during that debate, Walt spends about half an hour going through the genealogies and explaining why the gapping has got to be fairly significant. Now, I would agree with Walter. It's not significant enough to justify Adam and Eve being alive a million years ago, but certainly enough to explain how he could be alive, say, 50 to 60,000 years ago. But that's kind of a discussion that's going on. You know, how much gapping do we have there? And also recognition that the Hebrew words for father and son equivalently mean great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather. There's no distinction in the Hebrew word ab between a father, a great-grandfather, or a great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Likewise, there's no distinction in the Hebrew word ben for son between a son and a great-great-great-grandson. And if you look in the book of Daniel, Belshazzar refers to Nebuchadnezzar as his father. Four generations separate them, and they're not blood related. So the Hebrew words for father and son don't necessarily mean there has to be a blood link.
I would like to personally just thank you first for your material and the work you guys are doing at Reasons to Believe. Recently I got into going through your material, and I have a friend who's studying biology, and one of the problems she has, or the questions she has to deal with the near anatomically modern humans, hominids, Neanderthals, and what sort of purpose God could have for creating those, and if there's any sort of possible evolutionary connection. So I was just wondering if you could sort of explain your views on the
Well, when I was taking anthropology in my early years, we were taught that Neanderthals and humans are anatomically identical. That's no longer the case. We've discovered enough fossil evidence to realize that there are huge anatomical differences between human beings and Neanderthals. And, you know, it's a consensus now in the anthropological research community that Neanderthals are distinct from human beings, both in terms of their DNA and in terms of their bone structure, and especially in terms of their brain structure, very different. I forgot the first part of your question.
Just if we're not connected evolutionarily, what sort of purpose could God have?
Oh, yeah, what purpose would God have for making these creatures? Well, what we do note is that those continents which had the full panoply of bipedal primate species over the last several million years, Africa and Asia is where we see the greatest amount of evidence, those two continents suffered very little extinction of large-bodied bird and mammal species when human beings arrived on the scene, 14% or less. But when you talk about Australia, where we have no evidence of bipedal primates existing there, the extinction rate when human beings arrived was 86%. In North and South America, it was 73 and 79% respectively. And what you notice in the book of Job, it gives a list of advanced birds and mammals that God created to serve human beings and to help us launch civilization. You know, I got a book, in fact, the book has just arrived, by the way. We'll be able to make available to you my book, Hidden Treasures in Job. It's going to be arriving this week at our office. But in that book, I explain how vital those animals are for launching civilization. Notice in Australia and North and South America, the human inhabitants there never got past the Stone Age. It's because they wiped out the very animals that God had given them to launch and sustain civilization. They didn't have cows, they didn't have horses, they didn't have donkeys, they didn't have goats. I mean, those creatures, they had mountain goats, but they weren't able to exploit them. And therefore, they never got out of the Stone Age. It wasn't until people arrived from Europe and Africa and Asia and brought with them the animals, that they were able to get past the Stone Age limitation. So the Bible is silent on the issue, but that's at least one piece of data that I can give you that may offer some explanation of why God went to the trouble of creating a sequence of bipedal primates over the past 6.5 million years. Oh, let me just finish that off in this sense. Those bipedal primates enabled the birds and the mammals to adapt to the coming future shock of the human predator, the super predator. And those continents that lacked those introductions, the animals didn't have appropriate opportunity to adapt, and so when humans arrived, they got wiped out. Go ahead.
Hi. We believe the Big Bang creation event, you know, we identify it with a creation event, a creatio ex nihilo. People who want to say that you can't go, basically that's the fact that you go back to a singularity doesn't necessarily mean that you have ex nihilo, but let's say it's a vacuum fluctuation of some kind. So people invoke at least vaguely this notion of a vacuum quantum fluctuation. I think Steve Barr, I think it's his name, last year wrote an essay in which he said, well, even if it was a vacuum quantum fluctuation, you had to have the quantum system there. The laws of quantum mechanics had to be there, so it wasn't out of nihilo anyway.
Right.
But I was wondering, in terms of like the Heisenberg uncertainty pair, like, for example, energy, time, basically particle physicists tend to, you know, you say that you can violate conservation of energy for a short enough time that, you know, under the H-bar, you know, basically, as long as you can't measure it, you can violate it. Well, the singularity, because of all the energy that would be implied in that, and here I'm a little vague about it, it's hard to believe that something that now lasts billions of years could have been a fluctuation from the vacuum. And I was wondering, what are the most potent arguments against a quantum fluctuation?
Well, what I'm noticing is that the quantum fluctuation speculation is starting to disappear from the scientific literature. In fact, thank you for bringing this up. The first person that came to the microphone asked me about the quantum mechanics, and I didn't answer the question. I can't remember everything. So the reason why it's falling from favor is that there's now a recognition that without time, quantum mechanics can't do anything. Whether you appeal to the Heisenberg uncertainty or some kind of quantum tunneling, it requires time. And so if you're going to claim the universe came into existence through some kind of quantum fluctuation, that's going to require time. But the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time. So you can't explain the arrival of the universe and the arrival of space and time through any kind of quantum mechanics. And that's the reason why that argument is quickly disappearing from scientific dialogue, is that finally physicists are recognizing there's a problem with the space-time theorem and the idea that somehow quantum fluctuations can do anything for you. But your argument is also valid, is that yes, in quantum fluctuations you can get very dramatic departures from statistical and thermodynamic equilibrium, but it's got to snap back. In other words, you can get a virtual particle coming out, but it's got to go back into the space-time foam in less than a trillionth of a second. And so the fact is the universe is billions of years old, and according to the laws of quantum mechanics, if you're going to create something through some kind of virtual quantum particle production, it's got to go back into its state in less than a trillionth of a second, and the universe is a lot older than a trillionth of a second. But I think an easier way to settle it is just to say, hey, the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time. Quantum mechanics needs time.
Hi. I'm trying to boil this down into just a couple simple ways of trying to state this. I guess basically my questions deal with energies that we still don't understand on our planet. In the simplest form, you know, how we attribute something of paranormal to being a ghost or a spirit, or things that obviously we don't get in the same way that, I don't know, a couple hundred years ago, who could conceive of television or radio being able to see things that, you know, we never expected, but eventually there was a scientific formula, you know, that allowed us to do that and recreate it. my understanding, at least from the psychical research in Britain, is that until something can be repeated, it's not a science. So when people have certain psychic phenomena that occur, and having experienced so many of these things through my life, you know, I know what I experienced, I know what I saw, I know what I felt, and yet there's nothing I can find biblically that really explains that, or we have not got science to the point where we can recreate a ghost or a particular energy. Do you have any thoughts
on
that?
I think you'll find a book there called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, where we talk about the UFO phenomena and its links with the paranormal. And what we try to do in that book is actually make it a science, make it testable, make it repeatable. In this sense that, you know, I talk about the statistics of, say, close encounters with UFOs, and those are the ones that are most likely not to be explained by natural phenomena. Close encounter means closer than 500 feet, and you know, some are a lot closer than that. But when you look at the statistics of those UFO experiences, they most frequently happen at 3 a.m. in the morning on lonely country roads. Well, I'm an astronomer, and guess where we astronomers hang out? We hang out on lonely country roads at 3 a.m. in the morning. So you would expect, scientifically, that astronomers would have the highest incidence of UFO experiences, but in fact they have one of the lowest. But in writing this, I also talk about how there were two astronomers that I knew that every time they came on our telescope, they would have a UFO encounter. And these were two astronomers that typically logged between 4 and 6 hours of observing time per year. And there were three of us graduate students at the University of Toronto that were each logging more than 1,500 hours a year. We never saw a thing. These two guys come in the telescope, and every time they have an observing run, they have a UFO encounter. And so I got curious about that. I was a fairly new Christian, and said, you know, I need to know what's going on with these guys. It's not going on with us. There's got to be a distinction why we're not having these experiences and why they are. Well, I found out that both of these men were very deep into occult activity. And like a lot of physicists back in the 1960s and 1970s, were doing occult research. And just to give you kind of some of the background here, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union realized that they had huge technological disadvantages compared to the United States. The Americans may not have been aware of that, but they were painfully aware of it. You know, we were using transistors, they were still using vacuum tubes. Their copying machines were made out of cast iron with rivets. So just to give you an idea of the technological challenges that they were facing. And so they said the only way we can get a leg up on the Americans in terms of weaponry is through occult physics. And the first time I visited the Soviet Union, that's what I saw in every university. Each one had a department of occult physics, where they were doing things like seeing if they can get spoons to levitate on their own, or get temperature fluctuations. It was all funded by the Soviet government in the hopes that they'd be able to develop some kind of secret weapon. Well, this did not escape the notice of Americans. And so it was happening on some institutions here in the United States and Canada. They said, well, if the Russians are going to do this, we're going to do it too. And when I arrived on the Caltech campus, it was rather shocking for me to discover that some very famous physicists were secretly involved in this occult physics research. Some of it out of pure fascination, some of it out of the say, we got to keep ahead of the Russians. Consequently, several of my colleagues got quite deep into occult activity because there is clearly a link between the occult and these kinds of experiments. And we talk about this in our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, as a testable theory, in the sense that you'll be able to measure a correlation between the level of occult activity and the degree of these kinds of things like spoon levitations or temperature fluctuations or close encounters with UFOs or visitations from spirits. There's a very easy to draw a correlation. You know, northern Brazil, North Africa, very high incidence. Here in the United States, quite low. Well, you can actually look at the statistics of occult organizations and activities, you'll see a correlation. But to me, the biggest test of all is, and I've done this with a number of individuals, if you will take the steps to eliminate the occult links, that will end your close encounters with UFOs. Because I've known individuals who are having repeated encounters. And say, if you will simply do this, that will put an end to it. And they go ahead and do it, and indeed that's the end of their UFO experiences. So in that sense, I think we really do have a scientific model to explain the paranormal. Now, it's not always the individual. You know, when I talk to people who are having these kinds of experiences, they'll often tell me, I got no occult activities in my life. And I said, well, let's take this